This podcast is brought to you by Villanova University on iTunes U. Please visit us on itunes.villanova.edu.
Well, I just want to thank the introductions to Danielle and Jerusha for introducing me, and thanks, Villanova, for having me. And I hear there's a basketball game tonight. I hear there's something going on. So, unless it's a first-round game, I think it's going to be a blowout. So those of you that are here, I think a lot of credit to all of you. I think this is one of the seminal issues of our times, and I say that not only as a clinician and a professor, but as a parent. I have a 9-year-old twins, and so I have some skin in the game as a person who is raising children in a society that has gone through a seismic shift in, let's say, 10 or 12 years now. So let me just start. I want to ask the audience a question. So here's Exhibit A, right? A smartphone. And just by a show of hands, how many of you think that this handy-dandy innocent little device has the potential to be problematic? Just by a show of hands. Okay, and by a show of hands, how many of you think, what's he talking about? This is overrated, that this is just another generation of technology, just like the sky was falling with radio and then television and then this, and maybe this is just overblown, that this is just scaremongering, and let's just catch a breath, that this isn't probably that problematic, it's just another evolution of technology. How many of you think that? Okay. All right. So I want to start off by saying that I'm not a Luddite, and I'm not advocating, I'm not anti-technology. So the whole crux of the message in the book that I've written is the developmental and clinical impacts on children, because what children's brain development is very different than we as adults. And so while I love my phone, and my wife might think that I love my phone too much, it's very different with the impacts that we're seeing on children. And part of the problem has been people of my generation, and I'm 52, tend to view technology through the lens of their own experience growing up, and they haven't fully appreciated, I feel, the full impact of this generation of technology, which is qualitatively different than prior screen generations, which I'll get into in a second. So I first became, and by the way, can everybody hear me? Is this audible? I first became aware of there might be a problem. My Houston, we have a problem moment. About 10 years ago, I had a young man that was referred to my office who was about 16 years old. He was a junior in high school, and he came into my office. He had this Metallica t-shirt on, and he was disoriented. He was very confused. And he walked into my office, and he was blinking hard, and he was looking around like that. And I kept asking him, do you know where you are? And he kept blinking, and he kept looking around. And I kept asking him his name, and I kept asking him if he knew where he was. And finally, after a couple of minutes of looking around like that and blinking, he just looked at me, and he just said, "Are we still in the game?" And I said to him, "No, we're not in the game." And he was having, at that moment, a version of what has come to be called video game psychosis. He had been playing a game called World of Warcraft for 10 hours a night for several months, and had essentially entered the matrix, where he couldn't discern what was real and what was not real. We psychologists call that derealization, when a person doesn't know if I'm real or what else is real in the external world. And that young man had to get sent to a psychiatric hospital for over a month, where he was put on antipsychotic medications to retether himself to reality. And the part that I found really interesting about his story was there was no prior history of mental illness. There was no family history of mental illness, that it seemed that his psychotic episode was a direct byproduct of his immersion into gaming, or his over-immersion into gaming. And that was my first aha moment. That was my first, there's something interesting happening here, because we used to see substance-induced derealization, the old bad acid trip. Back in the 60s and 70s, if somebody had a bad acid trip and they had a hallucinatory experience, that was derealization. They didn't know what was real, what wasn't. And that we understood, but we had never seen before digitally induced derealization. And that was my first experience with it. And since then, I've had quite a few more experiences with young people that were having digitally induced derealization. So we'll back up a little bit. First, a little humor. Here's a little comic that I find kind of humorous. And there they sit. So back in the day, when the personal computer was first really being launched upon us, we had the sense that it was going to be the wonder tool. It was going to be the educational panacea, and that the PC held the promise of better educational outcomes. And back in 1996, there was a cover of Newsweek that really looked at that sort of future promise in a very idealized, almost Norman Rockwell way. And there you have her. She's a smiling young girl with her PC on her lap. And can PCs make your kid a better student? And that was the promise of 1996. And a few years later, this is what we got. And this was the Newsweek cover story of 2012 that looked at, and as you could see, it was panic, depression, and psychosis, some of the byproducts that we were beginning to see of this digital immersion. And I'll get into some of these clinical effects one at a time, because this, globally speaking, are some of the effects. We're talking about addictive effects. We're talking about attentional effects. We're talking about increased aggression, anxiety and depression, and potentially psychosis. And now I need to say that there's over 200 peer-reviewed studies that have correlated these disorders with excessive screen usage. And how many of you were aware of that, by the way? Just by a show of hands, how many of you were aware of some of this stuff? Okay. All right, you're a pretty involved group. Okay, so some of you were aware of some of this. The phrase that I use is that, generally speaking, as a society, we've been woefully underaware of some of these effects because we've just bought into the false, I call it a false narrative of the digital babysitter. And a lot of parents have sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, it's just the way things are now, and how bad can it be? The schools are giving the devices to my kids, so there's got to be some educational component to it, because certainly the schools, as the gatekeepers, are vetting these devices, are they not? And unfortunately, what we're finding is that that's not always the case. So this was a New York Times article three days ago, and our teenagers were placing drugs with smartphones, and the article had sort of a mixed perspective on it, because the good news is that adolescent drug use is down across the board. Pot smoking, alcohol, cocaine use is down. The bad news is, has it been replaced by something? Now, as a parent, we might say, all right, I'll take digital addiction over substance addiction. We might say that. And I wrote an op-ed for the New York Post that was called Digital Heroin that got a lot of, by the way, I didn't name that article. The editors called it Digital Heroin. Mine was Clinical Screen Effects, and I didn't think they found that. I don't think they found it as a... Didn't sell the papers, as they used to say, so Digital Heroin was it. And the point that I always make when I talk about digital heroin, which I have done on a lot of national television, certainly no one is saying that digital addiction is as lethal as the national opiate epidemic, for example. I'm an addiction specialist. I work with opiate addiction, alcoholism, crystal meth addiction, and digital addiction. It is not as lethal, although there have been fatalities, there are documented cases of gamers who have essentially gamed themselves to death by a heart attack, by playing multiple days without sleep and rest or food and water, and have died. Those are extreme outliers, granted, so I'm not saying that it's as lethal as the opiate epidemic, but I am saying they are as addicting, and that, as I'll show you, they parallel and mirror both the clinical and the neurophysiological effects of substance addiction. So in that sense, these are digital drugs. And what the article did go on to say, and Dr. David Greenfield is an assistant professor of psychiatry at UConn, people are carrying around a portable dopamine pump. And kids have basically been carrying it around for the last 10 years. And then Dr. Nora Valco, who's the head of NIDA, and NIDA is the National Institute of Drug Abuse, which is one of really the main national bodies that researches drug addiction, and her quote was, teens can get literally high when playing these games. Interactive media act as an alternative reinforcer to drugs. Now, how many of you, again, I keep asking you by a show of hands, think that actually just staring at a screen without ingesting, it's almost like magic, without ingesting any substances into your body can change your brain physiology? How many of you think that that is possible? Well, you would all be right. It is possible. A lot of people are shocked to hear that. People get that if I ingest a substance, that's going to change my brain chemistry. A mind-altering substance has to be consumed. But we know that the visual consumption of a mind-altering substance is also possible, and that's what we're seeing. So the first person that actually coined the term electronic cocaine was Dr. Peter Weibrow, and he was head of neuroscience at UCLA. And he started calling screen devices electronic cocaine because of these neurological effects. My friend and colleague, Commander Dr. Andrew Doan, started calling them digital pharmakia, from the Greek word, which means pharmaceuticals. And the Chinese researchers for the last two decades have been calling them digital heroin for the same reasons that we talked about. So how are they digital drugs exactly? And there's a little gamer. There's a little Hulk. So screen experiences are dopaminergic, and not all screen experiences are created equal. If we look at screen experiences on a continuum of dopamine activating or dopaminergic effects, not all screens are the same. So we would say something like first-person shooter games that are very adrenaline-activating, adrenaline-rousing, they're the most dopamine-activating, most dopaminergic, and something like watching a YouTube video or texting or social media is also dopamine activating, but not at the same level. So dopamine, for those of you that don't know, it's one of the feel-good neurotransmitters in the brain, and it's the one most correlated with addictive disorders. So addicts, any kind of addicts, behavioral addicts or substance addicts, do what we call they chase the dopamine high. So something tickles your dopamine receptors, and you release a dopamine squirt, you like that experience, and then you chase that high. And that's that repetitive, addictive, round and round behavior. Now, we know that not everyone is created equal when it comes to addictive predisposition. We know that about 10% of the population is predisposed towards addictive behavior. So not everyone is. Your genetics have a lot to do with it, social learning theory, how you were raised, emotional attachment. There's a whole host of etiological theories about why addicts are addicts. But it's about 1 in 10. The problem is we don't know who the 1 in 10 are. So if you're the lucky 10%, and again, I run treatment programs and I work with a lot of addiction. I worked with addicts who were federal judges, lawyers, professors, really bright people. Addiction does not mean you're stupid. Addiction does not mean that you weren't raised well. Some of the best and brightest people I know have addiction issues. We just don't know which color of the crayon box is predisposed towards addiction. So if you intersect an addictive experience or an addictive substance to one of those 10%, you might have that perfect storm of an addictive explosion. So they did a study back in 1998 by Dr. Cope. And Dr. Cope measured how dopamine activating certain behaviors and substances were. And again, how dopamine activating something is correlates with how potentially addicting it is. Again, if you're not predisposed towards addiction, you might not get bitten by any of these. But if you do have addiction in your family, and if you do have the predisposition, you have to be more cautious about certain exposure to certain substances. So we know that certain foods, especially craving foods like chocolate, are 50% dopamine activating. So people who say, I'm a chocolate addict, they kind of might kind of mean it. Now, we may not think of a chocolate addict as someone who's going to rob a bank to get money to get chocolate, and that kind of extreme. But there are people who eat chocolate in an unhealthy and compulsive way. We know that sex is dopaminergic. It's about 100% dopamine activating. And what the study with Dr. Cope found out was that video games were as dopamine activating as a sexual experience. And these were 1998 video games, which are like archaic by today's standards. They haven't replicated the study recently, and I would hazard to guess that today's video games have probably gone past that 100% mark. And cocaine is at 350%. So it's not quite cocaine, but it is sex. And the thing to keep in mind is that if you're an adult, you have a fully developed brain. And as an adult with a fully developed brain, that means you also have a fully developed frontal cortex. And the frontal cortex is what we call the executive functioning part of the brain. It controls our impulsivity, our consequential thinking, the rational part of who we are. And that doesn't fully develop until people are in their early 20s. That's why, we're the youngins in the room, that's why teenagers take a lot of what we would call risk-taking behavior. When you're 16 or 17, you might bungee jump and not wear a bicycle helmet and do things sexually that you probably shouldn't, that you might not do when you're 35. Because the part of your brain that says, hold on, that's not a good idea, has solidified. And so we also call the frontal cortex the brain's braking mechanism, right? So we have certain impulses, and our frontal cortex says, no, wait, not a good idea. So as an adult, if we experience something dopaminergic, something stimulating, again, like any adrenaline arousing experience, we have more fully developed brain physiology to moderate that. A seven-year-old does not. So if you give a seven-year-old something that's as stimulating as a sexual experience, and you say, now just do that for 10 minutes, they just don't have the apparatus to stop. And so we're setting our children up for failure because they can't control their impulsivity in the way that theoretically we adults can. And let's face it, we adults aren't always experts at controlling our impulsivity. I was just telling Jerusha last week, I'm doing a project with ABC Television, the news program 2020, and they had me fly to beautiful Columbus, Ohio. They had me fly to Columbus, Ohio to do an intervention on a video game addict, a 44-year-old video game addict, married to an attorney with four young children, and the video game addiction, like in exactly the same way as any other addiction, was destroying his family and his life. And he was 44. I mean, he is 44. And by the way, the intervention was successful. He's in treatment. We removed the over 500 video games that were in his house. He was shaking, and he went through what we would call a stimulant withdrawal. When people stop doing cocaine or stimulants abruptly, they go through it's not as pronounced as an opiate withdrawal like a heroin or a Percocet withdrawal, but you go through an agitation and a mood dysregulation, and he went through all of it. He was a gaming addict, it's a behavioral addiction, and he showed all the signs of withdrawal when we took his games away. So, video games are not addictive by chance. Dr. Doan, again, he's the head of addiction research for the U.S. Navy. The military had asked Dr. Doan to investigate video game addiction because, some of you may remember a few years ago, there was a pretty famous and infamous shooting called the Navy Yard shooting in Baltimore, where a 19-year-old Buddhist, former sailor from Queens, shot and killed 13 people. And what they had found was he was a gamer who had been playing Call of Duty day after day after day. And the other thing that happened with him before he went psychotic and killed all those people in the infamous Navy Yard shooting, he had gone to the VA hospital the night before the shooting to get sleep medication. Because the underappreciated aspect of gaming is the sleep dysregulation that it causes. It's a stimulant. If you drank 10 cups of Starbucks coffee before you went to bed, you wouldn't be able to sleep. If your kid is gaming hour after hour before bedtime, it's affecting his sleep pattern. His circadian sleep cycles or her circadian sleep cycles are getting affected. So oftentimes, kids on high-screen diets are very sleep-deprived. And I'll talk about what that begins to look like in the ADHD byproduct of that. But this young man who was the Navy Yard shooter was sleep-deprived, had been immersing himself in first-person shooter games, and essentially had a violent psychotic break. And bad things happen when people don't get a lot of sleep. And he hadn't slept for 3 or 4 days, And Dr. Doan was asked to investigate video game addiction in the military. And what Andy Doan told me, and we've become friends, he said, Nick, if you go to any barracks in the United States or around the world, most infantrymen or most privates or most entry-level soldiers, they're gamers. These are 18, 19, 20-year-old kids. They're coming from a gaming culture. They're getting put in very stressful PTSD potential types of situations, and the traditional escapes of drugs and alcohol aren't as available because they get drug tested. So if you go to any barracks, Dr. Doan tells me, he's a lieutenant commander in the Navy, you're going to have game boxes out all over the place. And a lot of these young soldiers who get traumatized with PTSD and escape through their virtual reality games are getting impacted pretty significantly. And they're using it as an escape. They're using it as an escape from some of their day-to-day problems. The other part that really impacts young people is what we would call the HPA axis. And that's the fancy way of saying it is the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis. What that essentially is the fight or flight response. And what happens is when you experience a hyper-stimulating screen experience, it raises your HPA thermostat. You go into fight or flight mode. Now the problem is that evolutionarily, we were designed to go into fight or flight response for brief periods of time. If our ancestors were chased by a tiger on the plains of Africa, we would go into an adrenal response because adrenaline would shoot to our hands or our feet so we could either run or we could fight. But our adrenal thermostat would get raised to handle that stressful situation, which would usually last for a few minutes, maybe half an hour, maybe an hour. What's happening is that kids who are excessively gaming are in this fight or flight mode hour after hour after hour after hour, so their adrenal thermostat gets raised significantly. What does that begin to look like? These kids begin to look hypervigilant. They begin to look, the phrase that we use is mood dysregulated. And what does that begin to look like? So now these kids begin to get diagnosed with ADHD, conduct disorder, attentional problems, and oftentimes these are byproducts of the hyperarousing screens that have led to what looks like these other presentations. I worked with, I'll show you the slide later, Dr. Victoria Dunkley is an adolescent psychiatrist in Los Angeles, and she's dealt with over 1,000 kids and adolescents over the last 10 years. She will not prescribe or diagnose a young person until they've gone off of technology for 4 weeks. Once they've done the 4-week technology fast, then she re-examines them. And what she's found is that 70% of the time, the presenting symptoms have gone away. And she's talking about ADHD effects, conduct effects, even spectrum effects for mild autism. It seems that the games or the screens are acting as toxins that are hyper-stimulating children in ways that developmentally are really problematic. When that op-ed was called Digital Heroin, and you know, that was a sort of a shock title, I discovered something that actually made me think it wasn't actually too far off. Dr. Doan turned me on to some research that I found particularly fascinating in this analogy of screens and their impacts that mirror drugs. At the University of Washington, they were beginning to do research with burn victims, and these were combat burn victims who were coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq. And for those of you that may or may not know, when you're a burn victim, part of the most painful part about being a burn victim is the daily wound care. You have to take off the bandages, scrub the burns, scrub the skin, and it's excruciating. And so oftentimes burn patients get very high doses of morphine to deal with the pain. What they found was that when these burn victim soldiers were immersed in a virtual reality game called Snow World, they felt no pain. The pain centers of their brains were more activated than they were by morphine. And in fact, I'll show you what it looks like. That's an actual military burn victim playing the game Snow World while he's being treated. And I had the honor of interviewing one of the pilot participants in the study, Lieutenant Sam Brown, who I wrote about in my book. And I asked him, because he was first given morphine, and then they treated him with the virtual reality game. And he said to me, Dr. Cardaris, when they gave me the morphine, I felt it. I still felt the pain. When I was playing Snow World, I felt nothing. And the game was a much more powerful analgesic painkiller than the actual morphine. Now, look, this is a wonderful use of technology for pain management. I think this is great for combat soldiers who have suffered burns. The problem is we're giving this digital morphine to seven-year-olds, and we're not really sure yet what that's going to look like longitudinally over the next 5, 10, 15, or 20 years. And that's what I think the ultimate message, and by the way, this is Snow World, this is the game. So they throw, and this is not, by the way, some horrific first-person shooter game. It's a pretty innocuous game, and with Paul Simon music playing in the background. I got a chance to play it. So you throw snowballs at little penguins, and you've got a little Paul Simon ditty, and yet that's endorphin raising. Endorphin raising to a pretty powerful degree because of the immersive aspect of it. That's the key part that I think my generation has failed to understand. Let me make a key distinction between television and today's screens. They're different for four fundamental reasons. TVs, yesteryear's TV, the old black and white with the rabbit ears on top of it, that was a two-dimensional passive viewing experience. Today's screens are immersive. In other words, you get sucked in. They're interactive, so you become actually usually a participant within the screen. They're portable, and they're ubiquitous. So immersive, interactive, portable, ubiquitous. And portable means, look, I wasn't able to carry around my old 12-inch TV back when I was in fifth grade, and so I watched when I watched, but now our technology is everywhere. And so the ubiquity of it means the instant gratification of it is right there at any second. That dopamine squirt is available whenever I want. As that New York Times article said, that dopamine pump is whenever I need it. So the interesting part about how the brain was affected and how the brain architecture was affected, because not only were screens dopamine activating, but they were beginning to change the neurophysiology of the brain. So what we know is that chronic drug addiction compromises the frontal cortex. So if you look at multiple-year cocaine addicts, MRIs, their frontal cortex, the gray matter, it's called the DGM, dense gray matter, gets less dense, and the gray matter shrinks. And so it's kind of a double whammy for addicts, because if you're an addict, the part of your brain that makes you less impulsive gets compromised, and so then you become more impulsive. And so it's kind of a vicious cycle, the thing that your drug addiction is making you less able to control your drug addiction. And what they found is that screen experiences do the same effect to that frontal cortex. And several brain imaging studies over the last 3 or 4 years have shown that kids on screens and teenagers and young adults on screens were showing gray matter deficits in their frontal cortex. Now, the one study that I think was the most powerful with that, because most of those studies showed gamers, they did the brain scans after they were gamers. They found gamers and they did brain scans and they found that gamers had smaller frontal cortexes. But they couldn't really prove whether it was the games that caused that. Maybe people with smaller frontal cortexes gravitate towards gaming. This study at the Indiana University School of Medicine took young adults that weren't gamers. They weren't screen people. And then they exposed them to 10 hours of video games for 1 week. And after 1 week, Dr. Wang, who is the lead researcher, said, for the first time, we have found that a sample of randomly assigned young adults showed less activation in certain frontal brain regions following a week of playing violent video games at home. The affected brain regions are important for controlling emotion and aggressive behavior. The frontal brain regions are also the same brain regions that are affected by drug addiction. For the first time, researchers showed a direct relationship between playing violent video games and the subsequent change in those brain regions associated with executive functioning. So these were clearly defined neurophysiological effects in the brain imaging study at a fairly prestigious medical school. And here you can see actually the bottom part, the bottom three panels show the less activation. The top three brains with the orange spots show the more activation in the frontal cortex. The bottom, the middle, and the bottom right show the less activation. What happens, essentially, this is your brain on video games, less activation in key parts of your executive functioning. I'm not going to go into the detail, but there's been several studies that show what I just said about gray matter effects on the frontal cortex. There's also been abnormalities in what's called the white matter, or the myelination, the myelin sheath. For those of you who don't know, your myelin sheath is like an insulation cable that surrounds your axons, and your axons are the long part of your neurons. And so think about it like Wi-Fi or like cable insulation. And so myelin is actually a lipid. It's a fatty lipid. And the healthier your fatty lipid myelin is, the faster your brain works. The more compromised, the more porous, the less thick your myelin sheath is, the slower your brain works. And in fact, there are certain neurological developmental disorders like Alzheimer's and addiction where they've shown that the myelin sheath is compromised. Well, now research has also shown that excessive screen usage is also compromising the myelin sheath, also known as the white matter. So beyond addiction effects, I mentioned Victoria Dunkley before, the adolescent psychiatrist. A much broader concern begs awareness is the risk that screen time is creating subtle damage even in children with quote-unquote regular exposure. I observe that many of the children I see suffer from sensory overload, lack of restorative sleep, and a hyper-aroused nervous system, regardless of diagnosis, what I call electronic screen syndrome. These children are impulsive, moody, and can't pay attention. So we've had a couple of studies that have looked at the ADHD effect. And back in 2004, there was a study by Dr. Christakis at University of Washington that showed that for every hour of screen time, there is a 10% higher rate of ADHD as that child gets older. And in 2010, more than 2 hours a day in front of a screen, computer or television, we're twice as likely to have attentional problems. When you think about it, attention is a developmental window in the same way that language is a developmental window. If you don't learn the language between usually the ages of 2 and 10, the developmental window to ever be able to learn the language begins to shut. And so we've seen, like in feral children, that were never exposed to language, when they're 15 or 16, sometimes they can learn basic language, but never idiomatic language or metaphor. Attention is like that as well. Our children, when they're between the ages of 2 and 5 and 6, they're developing their ability to attend. And the best thing for them to do is to be able to sort of focus, and the worst thing to do is to hyperstimulate them during that developmental window, because that hyperstimulation negatively impacts their ability to attend. And so what you're doing is you're creating a startle effect where the kids look like they're engaged because it's something stimulating, but when you take away the external stimulation, they can't sit still. The best thing that developmental psychologists talk about that you can do to your children to help them develop good focus is to allow them to be bored. If your child is bored, that's fantastic, because then your child has to use their interior neurosynaptic muscles to create their own either imagery or their own imagination, their own active play, and that's what builds their neurosynaptic muscles the most. Give a child a stick, give them some blocks, have them create with hand-eye. That's what builds the neurosynaptic muscle. Passively stimulate a child, that's what atrophies the developmental parts of their brain that are creative. With 1,000 kids that I've worked with, I can say without a doubt, every year's cohort is less imaginative, less engaged, less curious. What we've done by hyper-stimulating this generation of kids is if we've dampened their creativity. They no longer have to create mental imagery because we've programmed mental imagery. There was a great quote a few years ago, or actually many years ago, Remember back when MTV showed music videos? Remember back in the day, it used to be music television with actual videos? So Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, to you young folks in the room, that used to be a band that used to play music. Graham Nash gave a quote one time, and he said that Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young will never make a music video. I mean, they'll make concert videos, but they'll never make a music video. And he was asked why. And he said, we want our listeners to create their own imagery, their own music video in their minds when they hear our songs. We don't want to program the song or the visuals that they see when they hear our music. And I'll ask you all to do a thought experiment. Now, I happen to be on the cusp. I remember life pre-MTV and I remember life post-MTV. Think of a song that you've never seen the music video for. And usually, when you think of a song that you've never seen the music video for, your own point of reference comes up, some memory, some connection to that song, which is very individualized, which is your own unique imagery comes up. Now think of a song that you've seen the music video for. The video pops into your brain. We can't help it. We got programmed. And that's what we've done to our children. We've robbed them of the ability to create their own interior landscape imagery, and we've programmed them with visual imagery that they don't have to work for. And when you don't have to work to create your visual imagery because you're getting so much overload of sensory imagery, it becomes a vestigial organ. You're no longer able to create your own imagery at that point. And so adolescents that I work with today who were on high-screen diets from when they were little tend to have a harder time writing a story, imagining something. They need to see it. And that's part of one of the biggest impacts that we sometimes underappreciate. The aggression effect on video games. I'll get to social media as well. This is not all about video games, but there's been over 20 years of research, primarily out of Iowa State and Dr. Craig Anderson and his team, that clearly shows that violent media content, and specifically gaming, leads to higher aggression rates. They did a study that looked at a meta study that looked at 100 and a meta study looks at a bunch of different studies. So they looked at 130 studies that included over 130,000 participants, and it came to the conclusion that violent video games and aggression, it's not just a correlation. The violent imagery is causal. It leads to higher aggression. Now, that doesn't mean that every kid who plays a violent video game is going to become a school shooter. But is that kid more aggressive? Will that kid push his sister more or give his mom a kick? And what I'm seeing, because I'm in touch with hundreds of parents throughout the country, kids who are gamers are more aggressive kids. But think about anybody on a stimulant. When you've had, those of you who are adults in the audience, have 3 or 4 cups of Starbucks and you're driving on the highway, are you more likely or less likely for road rage? Any stimulant gets the adrenaline, gets the aggressiveness going. And when you think about it, that's what these games are for our children. They're stimulants. So they raise the aggression level. Back in 2000, the heads of the AMA, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Psychological Association, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, they all signed this joint statement, this joint letter about entertainment violence on children. And this is just the key quote. At this time, well over 1,000 studies, including reports from the Surgeon General's Office, the National Institute of Mental Health, and numerous studies conducted by leading figures within our medical and public health organizations, our own members, point overwhelmingly to a causal connection between media violence and aggressive behavior in some children. The conclusion of the public health community, based on over 30 years of research, is that viewing entertainment violence can lead to increases in aggressive attitudes, values, and behavior, particularly in children. I don't want to belabor this point, but this was a pretty high-profile case. Dan Petrick, he was profiled on National, and he was the video game when there was a national debate about what role video games were having in violence. Dan Petrick was a pastor's son in Ohio. Ohio seems to have a lot of gaming. So he had never gamed before, and he was, by all accounts, a normal kid. He was an outdoor athletic kid who got into a snowboard accident, and he hurt his leg. And so he had to be homeschooled for a period of time because of the accident. And a buddy of his gave him an Xbox, and he started playing Halo. Within 2 weeks, he was playing 18 hours a day. So, you know, we might say that he had the addictive predisposition, perhaps. So his father became concerned, and his father took away the game, the Xbox and the Halo, and locked it in the lockbox. And Dan Petrick snuck into his father's room, broke open the lockbox, took the game, and found his father's gun in there as well. And he went into their bedroom, and he shot both his mother and father. His mother wound up dying. His father survived a gunshot wound to the face. And his sister came home right at the time of the shootings and knocked on the door. He tried to shoo her away. She heard moaning from the back room, from the bedroom, from the father still being alive. She pushed him out of the way, called 911. It's a pretty powerful 911 call. And when the police came, he had made a getaway in the family van. The police circled the van and captured him. And guess what he had riding shotgun with him? Yeah, the Xbox and the Halo. So he's serving, I think it's 23 to life right now. And he's been in jail for about 7 or 8 years. And they've done interviews with him in jail. And he says, am I blaming the games? No, but in the games, when you push the reset button, people come back to life. And it had blurred his sense of not only what was real in life and death, but also that compulsion to play overrode some of rational thinking, which he seems to be rational now while he's in prison because he's been game-free for 7 years. I won't get to this one. We have a lot of children here, so I'll skip that. This guy. I've read the Attorney General's report. I've read the FBI report. I'm absolutely convinced that Adam Lanza in Newtown, Connecticut, had video game psychosis. He obviously had underlying psychiatric issues. He had severe OCD. He was on the spectrum. His mother pulled him out of school at the age of 15. And when she pulled him out of school, all he did was play video games in his basement, literally every waking moment of his life. And in his video game world, he was this powerful avatar called Canebread. And he played some very violent first-person shooter games. Not only did he play a game called Modern Warfare 2, where you shoot civilians in an airport, including women and children, and post-mortem, they looked at his gaming profile, and he'd killed 22,000 civilians in his gaming profile. But he was playing a game called School Shooter. Yes, there's a game called School Shooter, where you go classroom to classroom and you shoot children. A lot of people say, how is that possible? How can they make a game called School Shooter? And the gaming industry, by the way, spends more money on lobbying than the NRA does. And so there's First Amendment issues. And there's also a game, by the way, called Columbine, for those of you who are interested. So this is an example of a psychiatrically very vulnerable teen who was exposed to some very toxic influences and exposed to firearms, and it was a lethal combination. The FBI did conclude that, by the way, the one investigator said this was the work of a gamer, and they had a couple of reasons why they said that. I won't get into the details of it. Let's switch over to social media, a happier subject. So we're hardwired social animals. We need psychologically and emotionally to have human connection. And they've done lots of experiments about what happens to people when we're in isolation or when we don't have human contact. We get physically ill. We go insane. Dr. Hebb, back in the 1950s, did some very unethical human research that you wouldn't be able to do today. But he put people in isolation. They were blindfolded, and they had mitts on their hands, and they had no physical contact with any. They couldn't touch, see, smell, and had no other human contact. And he wanted to see, and these were college students, by the way, and they got $25 to participate in the study, and he wanted to see what would happen to people who were totally isolated after 2 weeks. Not one of them made it 3 days. They went insane by the third day. They started seeing, one young man saw giant 6-foot bunny rabbits jumping around. They all went different types of crazy. The takeaway is we need human connection. It's part of our DNA. So if we're social animals and we have this cool thing called social media, you would think that it would be a recipe for wonderful psychological outcomes. Yet, paradoxically, as social media has expanded, and over 1.23 billion people are on Facebook. Strangely, depression rates are skyrocketing. And the World Health Organization says that depression is going to be the number two debilitating illness by the year 2020. So why and how is that? Shouldn't social media be helping fortify our needs for socialization? The problem seems to be that some people have called social media a parody of real human connection. They've done studies where, in fact, one Facebook depression study, and there's a phenomenon I'm sure many of you have heard, the Facebook depression effect. In one study, the more Facebook friends you had on Facebook, the higher your percentages of having depression. And why is that? Well, it's this idea that if you think you have social supports on Facebook, is it beginning to eliminate your face-to-face interactions? And there's some research that shows that for face-to-face contact to be meaningful, to be resonant, you have to maintain eye contact. Remember that thing, eye contact? 70% of the time. They've done several studies on this. So for an interaction to have social and psychological relevance and resonance, 70% of the time you have to maintain eye contact. According to that study, today's adolescents maintain eye contact 20 to 30% of the time. So even the face-to-face interactions that our young people are having aren't face-to-face enough to create that meaningful psychological component that we need. Making eye contact is becoming a lost art because of the head-down glow. And that's species-defining. That's problematic. Whatever we may think of technology, the loss of social and our interpersonal skills is significant. There's been various studies that showed about the depression effects, which we talked about. Facebook depression, one of the main aspects of Facebook depression is what was known as the comparison effect. And people were getting more depressed than when they were going on Facebook, because what do you see when you go through your newsfeed on Facebook? What do you see in your Facebook friends? Do you see them really bummed out and looking down? And do you see like your friends in their worst moments? We tend to put our idealized self on Facebook. This is me on vacation, happy. And if I'm having a rough day and I see a bunch of happy people on vacation, it's going to bum me out. And so it amplifies that blue state of depression. The more happy faces I see, and if I'm feeling kind of a rough day, the more it'll amplify my own sense of depression at that point. We talked a little bit before about this idea of psychotic effects, and there's been some research. Mark Griffiths and Gortari looked at it. They called video game psychosis game transfer phenomenon. And this generation of screen technology is so searing into the psyche that every one of the 1,600 gamers that they had in their study had some level of what we call game transfer phenomenon, where aspects of the game blurred into their everyday life. So that was everything like hearing voices from the game a day or two later, seeing parts of the game in their visual field. Kids who were playing Minecraft started seeing, there was reports of them seeing trees in the shape of cubes. The game started shaping the perception of reality. This is becoming much more common the more time that, well, let's face it, if the average teenager is on screens 11 hours a day, and if a bulk of that time is on reality blurring gaming, it's going to start shaping your perception of reality. It can't not. So we're going to switch over to education effects in the classroom. I wrote an op-ed a little while back for Time magazine. I think you could tell what I think about technology in schools. So what did we find out? So as was mentioned before by Danielle, it's a $60 billion a year global industry. At least it will be by next year. And so we have a lot of examples of what are called edupreneurs who are trying to capitalize on bringing technology into the classrooms. Now, we heard before Danielle talked about people like Steve Jobs and Silicon Valley, people not having their kids in high-tech schools and in Waldorf or Montessori schools. And by the way, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, The Google boys, they were Montessori students, never touched a computer until they were 12. eBay founder, what's the eBay founder's name? Somebody, quick, what's the guy's name who founded eBay? Well, the eBay guy, he never also touched a computer until he was 12 or 13. Bill Gates, Microsoft, he didn't touch a computer until he was 12 because he had invented, but... Same thing with Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was a tinker in his garage. But most of the powerful brains in technology didn't have technology when they were infants or kids or children. They let their brains develop and then have at it. Have at it with technology once your brain blossoms. But people like Rupert Murdoch is not known for his educational concern. And he tried to cash in as an edupreneur, and he hired Joel Klein, who used to be the New York City schools chancellor from 2001 to 2012. And Joel Klein was making $225,000 a year as schools chancellor, and Rupert Murdoch hired him at $2 million a year to be the educational frontman of his company, Amplify, and then he gave him $1 million signing bonus. Rupert Murdoch needed an educational shill, somebody with educational bona fides to be able to sell this idea of a tablet for every kid. You know, K through 12, you know, a chicken in every pot and a tablet in every classroom for every kid. That became sort of the mission statement. But there was no research behind it. There was no research behind, and it was, the pretense was it's educational, it's individualized learning, and so forth. But what the research did show was that classes without screens had better test scores, and we have examples from around the world, like the country of Finland, by the way. Finland is always at the top of the international educational rankings, and Finland has rejected individualized devices. The Minister of Education in Finland has said, we've done quite well, thank you, without tablets and iPads and smartphones, and we're going to continue in the traditional format. And they focus on teacher training, taking outdoor breaks, giving the kids time to... They're not focused on standardized testing and technology. They're focused on teacher and student learning and that engagement, that Socratic ideal. And they're the ones who have the best outcomes. John Balance is a pretty interesting guy. He's the head of the most respected school in Australia, Sydney Grammar. And his quote a couple of months ago was, I think when people come to write the history of this period in education, this investment in classroom technology is going to be seen as a huge fraud. Sydney Grammar has produced 4 prime ministers in Australia. It's known as, like I said, the top school in Australia. And he also is opposed to individualized technology. And again, just more research. The OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation Development. This is a very important leading international group that looks at education throughout the world. And their 2015 report, heavy users of computers in the classroom do a lot worse than most learning outcomes. And an exhaustive study at Durham University in 2012 looked at 48 studies, and they found that technology-based interventions tend to produce just slightly lower levels. Technology's turned against me. Slightly lower levels of improvement compared with other research interventions. And again, more the Alliance for Children, the consortium with some of the nation's top educators. School reform is a social challenge, not a technological problem. A high-tech agenda for children seems likely to erode our most precious long-term intellectual reserves, our children's minds. Patricia Greenfield, she was a very eminent psychologist at UCLA. She looked at more than 50 studies, and studies show that reading develops imagination, induction, reflection, critical thinking, as well as vocabulary in a way that visual media, such as video games and TV, do not. And she found out that young people were reading less. This was interesting. There was a Canadian study in 2011 on 1,300 undergraduates, And the researchers thought that the undergraduates would respond better to technological interactive learning. And what they found was that it wasn't the case, that actual students really craved a human professor. And they really seemed to like access to human interaction, the smart person at the front of the classroom. Ann Magnan is a reading specialist who has done research in Norway, and she had found that reading something on the radiant screen versus reading something on paper, and the comprehension rates are different. Same content, but the comprehension rates are up to 20% better on paper. Now, there's a couple of reasons why that is. There's this idea of, you know, they talk about the topography of the page. When you're scrolling through something, you're not really oriented, and you don't have that north, south, east, west, four corners of a page, which gives you a sense of orientation and points of reference as you're reading. When you're scrolling, it can get very disorienting, like what paragraph, where am I, what planet am I on? So there's that, and there's also the radiant screen effect. Blue light is not natural, and there's some theories that the radiant light itself negatively impacts our cognitive abilities. That the light itself is problematic, not just that it's a screen, but it's the artificial light that is also problematic in our cognition. We heard earlier how Steve Jobs was not down with tablets for his kids, and that was in the 2010 New York Times interview. And his biographer said that every evening Steve made a point of having dinner at the big long table in their kitchen discussing books and history and a variety of things. No one ever pulled out an iPad or a computer. When I give these talks, this seems to be one of the most powerful things that people hear, that the people who are designing our technology don't let their kids use it. What does that tell us? Finally, phones in the classroom. A fairly recent study, London School of Economics, looked at phones in the classroom. In England, they're going in the opposite direction as we are in the United States. They're beginning to remove phones more and more from the classroom for the distractions that they are. And they did a study with over 130,000 students over a 10-year period, and they found that test scores went up 6% just by removing the phones. The researchers said, quote, "The best way to reduce the achievement gap in schools, especially inner city schools, was remove the telephones, because for special needs students and poor socioeconomic students, test scores went up 14%. The phone in the pocket, I've observed thousands of classrooms in my travels and part of the work that I do. I don't know how many of you have spent time in classrooms, but the classrooms that have out-of-sight policies, I've talked to, again, hundreds of teachers. Some teachers, there's two ways that teachers handle the phones in the classroom. So the kids will take their phones out, and the teachers will start saying, put it away, put your phone away, put the phone away, and they'll devote the first 10 minutes of a 40-minute class telling the 10 or 15 kids to put their phones away, or they raise the white flag and don't even bother. I'm going to teach these kids here who don't have their phones out, and the other kids could, you know, text and play games, and they give up. I've had many teachers tell me I'm tired. I'm frustrated at fighting the fight of having kids to put their phones away in schools. And when I ask administrators, why don't you have a no phones policy? New York City, the entire city, 1.2 million students for under Mayor Bloomberg had no phone policies. And now under Mayor Bloomberg, under Mayor de Blasio, they've changed that back to phones. And most administrators tell me it's the parents. We'd like to have no phones in the classroom, but the parents fight us on that because the parents say we need to reach our kids. How did we reach kids 10 or 15 years ago? There was a thing called a landline, and you called the school office, and they paged the child. And so it's not as if kids are in some, you know, remote mountaintop without any communication access. But the parents have the voice here. And that's been my message. The more I think that we become aware of some of these issues, and the more we find our voices as parents, the more we can demand less screens at early ages, less phones in the classroom. And that's my biggest takeaway, is The best thing you could do for your child is delay the onset of their exposure to technology. Wait as long as possible. There's absolutely no reason to drop that tablet into the crib. Or in utero, as some people I think want to do these days. The longer you wait, the more your child's brain will develop appropriately, and then the more they'll be able to effectively access technology as they get older. But if you preempt that process, it's really, really difficult. I've worked with screen issues and screen addiction. It's one of the most difficult addictions to treat, much more so. I say this with all sincerity. I find it easier to treat substance addiction than I do screen addiction. We have established protocols to treat substance addiction, and people can be abstinent from drugs and alcohol. You know, we have abstinence-based treatment models, and we know how to get people clean and sober. It's almost impossible to be abstinent from technology in today's 21st century America. So I've worked with young people that have fallen off the addiction cliff with their devices, and I'm not just talking about a little screen time. Kids who have really developed serious psychiatric issues as a result of their screens. And some of them do digital detoxes or get sent away to schools like wilderness programs or therapeutic schools where they don't have screen devices. And some of them, when they re-enter society, are able to navigate screens in a basically healthy way. And some of them are not. I had one young man who was the son of a pretty high-profile celebrity. And this young man had some serious problems as a result of his screen use. He went away to therapeutic school for 2 years. From 16 to 18, moved back with mom when he turned 18, 1 week of a smartphone, and he was off the cliff again. And he had been screen-free for 2 years. So it's a little bit of Russian roulette, and that's why I think the best thing that I could say is an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of digital cure. And so if you could all slow down let's face it, the genie's out of the bottle. We're not going to put the genie back in. But we can be more cautious and more careful about the effects on our youngins. And at this point, this has become my mission statement, because I do feel that as an advocate, we have to raise awareness, because we're fighting some very wealthy and powerful forces that have really don't really have our children's best interests at heart, I hate to say. And if we do care about the future of their development, we have to be the ones who are vigilant. So I'll open it up to any questions at this point, or any dissent or any agreement. Yeah, you're going to have to speak up in the back. Yeah.
When I hear you mention ages maybe 2 to 7 and the word addiction, I kind of feel like, okay, well, most of us are off the hook. We've passed that age, we're not addicts. But then when I hear you mention, I think you said teen average screen time is 11 hours. I mean, it sounds like we're all in a lot of trouble.
Yes. Look, I did the digital intervention with a 44-year-old, as I said before. The most vulnerable period is at 2 to 7, but it doesn't mean that you make it to 8, you've tagged out and you're immune. It means you're somewhat less vulnerable to the impacts, because you're a little bit developmentally further along. Yes. So I get asked this question a lot. What's the time? Is it an hour? Is it 2 hours? Is it 45? Is it 48 and a half minutes? The problem is everyone is different. Every single complex human being is different. And so one 12-year-old could have no problem with an hour a day. And another 12-year-old can fall off the cliff with an hour a day. And so what really, this is an individualized process for the parents to monitor. The things to look for is, how do the screens affect your children? So what are the red flags to look for? Does your child tend to get, here's the fancy phrase again, mood dysregulated? Now, children will throw temper tantrums when you take away their chocolate ice cream, but children will punch holes in walls when you take away their screens, and they will punch their parents. So does your child get overly aggressive and agitated and mood dysregulated when they have to take away their devices? That's a red flag.
Does your child now begin to substitute screen time for real time more and more and more? So do they quit the soccer team? Do they quit playing music? And now is it more and more screen time? Because let's face it, it's all about balance. So if a child can maintain, or a teenager can maintain balance, if you're still playing basketball and you've got some screen time, but it seems like your life is functioning, all right, then that young person is showing some ability to navigate healthy. If you're locked in your room and you're on a device and you're beginning to say, I'm school phobic, and I've worked with a lot of those, I can't go to school anymore, I've got anxiety now, and I could only... I'll give you a real-life example. I worked with a pair of twins. I worked with twins. I didn't work with four kids. It was two kids. And they were freshmen. When they both got in trouble, they both pulled a prank. They took a cover off of a cesspool, and they covered it up, and they tricked the kid. A kid almost died in the cesspool. So these two kids, who were the merry pranksters, got suspended for a year, and they were on home instruction. Identical twins. The one twin became very, very addicted to gaming because all he did was stay home all day and game. And so he eventually became agoraphobic, school phobic, couldn't leave the house, and they started giving him home instruction each year. He had a CSC, and at every CSC he kept getting. Now the other twin went back to school and was living a healthier life. Now they asked me to go do a home assessment on him as a senior. Now it had been 4 years since I had seen him, since he'd been a freshman. And again, we had a twin study happening. We had a real-life twin. And I, by the way, I'm the father of twins as well, so I got my own twin study happening. But I went to their house, and the healthy twin was outside playing basketball, and the screen twin was inside. And I'm not exaggerating when I say this. So he was about 70 pounds heavier than the other one. And it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He had just woken up, and he was in this semi-catatonic state, kind of like drooling, kind of, and I walked in, and I was genuinely shocked at what I saw, because I hadn't seen him since he was a freshman, and he looked so different than his brother. And so I said to him, you know, do you remember me? Do you, you know, could barely speak. And then I said magic words. Tell me about your gaming. He lit up. Well, and he started telling me, he came to life. And then he said, but he still had a hard time speaking. And so he said, can I show you? And he took me into his den. And he had these 3 wraparound screens. And he put his screens on. And as they lit up, he lit up. And while playing, he became verbal again. And he started talking, I could do trick shot, blah, 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 blah. He became hyperverbal, actually. And then I said, all right, 20 minutes of that, I've seen enough, let's go back into the living room. As soon as the game's powered down, he powered down. And he went back into the living room, and he kind of sat there, and he talked about it, and there were holes all over the wall, the signs of the mother's frustration. I kept trying to unplug him, get the games away. He's gotten violent, she had a restraining order at one point. And his whole life was different now. And now he was 18, and now he was an adult. Now mom couldn't even control him anymore, and she couldn't force him into treatment. And the other brother was healthy. And it was 1 year of screens and video games that had really changed this trajectory of this young man's life. And it was powerful to see the difference in those two kids. So how much is enough? It all depends. Yeah.
You had mentioned before a lot of the disruptive gaming was violent.
Right.
How about the games
without violence?
That are non-violent or educational or...
There's the magic word.
Well, I think it does as a math problem, so I'm just curious about that. And also, after this question hits.
Well, would you consider a game like Minecraft non-violent?
Well, it doesn't look like it when I see it.
But they are killing animals, right? You know, in Minecraft, they're killing animals, they're getting ores, they're... So...
Oh, I just see them building. Isn't that the one we built?
Minecraft was invented by the Mojang company, and they use what's called a variable reward ratio. And that's the same reward ratio as a slot machine. There's no axe, so this idea that, so when you hit, in Minecraft, you have a pickaxe, and you try to find the ores, and you find an ore... In variable, you don't get it every second time, every third time. It's like when you pull the slot machine,
You don't get the three cherries in a row every time, but you keep playing until you get it, because that's the most addicting and compulsive kind of reward ratio. So the top behavioral psychologists design Minecraft and some of the video games to make them as habit-forming as possible. So there's this veil of he's building something, but at the end of the day, it's a hypnotic, addictive game, and it's better if you actually build something called Lego than the fake digital Lego, because it's not really digital Lego. It's got other layers to it that make it more problematic. And even non-violent, like you saw Snow World. I showed you the one with the burnt soldiers. Little snowballs, penguins. But it was like morphine. It was hypnotic. It was endorphin-raising like morphine, and that wasn't even really a violent game either. It's the hypnotic effect that makes it. It's the immersive hypnotic effect that's problematic.
You have that going on doing math problems or...
Well, in the continuum of screens, I think those are less problematic. You know, if somebody's playing a math screen game, it's not as problematic as Call of Duty. But again, the screen experience itself can become hypnotic. And again, you get used to that screen experience. And Dr. Mocky was an education professor. He talked about screens compress space and time. And then the person becomes used to that compressed space and time. So then the real world seems boring. Like I'm used to, you know, getting the goal, getting the point, getting that. Now all of a sudden I've got to walk through life. And let's face it, a lot of the games, we haven't talked about the archetypal escaping games. There's games like, how many of you play World of Warcraft? Any of you play archetypal games? Anybody play? We are wired for so most archetypal games have a hero's journey. You've got to overcome obstacles, you get a reward, and you go through a transformation. If your life sucks, if your everyday reality, and let's face it, high school is hard. I've been through high school, and I worked in the high school for 15 years. High school can be really hard. It's a hard transitional age. The digital age has amplified all the things that were notoriously difficult about this awkward transition period of high school. So now bullying, 20 years ago when you were bullied by 5 kids, now you're bullied by 5,000. You're cyber-bullied by 5,000 kids. You make a mistake in high school today, it never goes away. You know, 20 years ago, okay, maybe you would live down some nickname after 3 or 4 years, but today, it's an amplification of some of these toxic effects that have been traditional rites of passage that are now amplified. And so if you're a bullied kid, and I write in my book about a young man that I worked with who was mildly on the spectrum, but a really sweet blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy whose family life was horrible. His parents were disabled, there were animals, and it was filthy, it was like a pigsty. CPS was always at his house. And one day he walked to school, and cockroaches came out of his sweatshirt. And guess what his nickname became for the next 4 years? Roach Boy. So now, and he was the most sensitive, fragile, sweet kid, but he was Roach Boy. Now, this kid, Roach Boy, I hate to call him that, but he played Final Fantasy XIV for 12 hours a day, because in Final Fantasy XIV, you're saving worlds, there are these light orbs, and you're saving galaxies. Now, would you rather be Roach Boy, or would you rather be a mythical archetypal character saving universe? I got why he played video games. We get it. We understand why people escape through various addictions. The challenge becomes to substitute that with something that might be healthier to empower him, to make him feel that his life is, his real life is worth living, not his synthetic life in some of these synthetic worlds.
Yeah. I wonder if you have any advice that you found effective in explaining these issues to 11, 12-year-old kids who don't maybe have the capacity to understand, even hearing these things, the impact they have. Well, what's been effective in getting them to get it?
Well, okay, my twins are 9, and you know, since they were 5, I you know, call it like the drug talk, or this. I talked honestly to them. I said, if you guys start playing video games, they were into baseball at the time, you might not play as much baseball. And I would say to them, you know, your brain
sometimes goes through effects that are not always that good. And I would try to, I would simplify the talk, but I would talk to them very honestly about it. And I think I was telling you what scared them was in second grade, they had a friend on their baseball team, one of their best buddies, who fell off the Minecraft cliff. Quit baseball, wouldn't leave the house, stopped playing with him. And that scared them straight. They said, oh my God, little Tommy, he's different. And I said, that's what sometimes happens when kids begin to. And so they've been, you know, they go on sleepovers and play dates. And, you know, so far, you know, I'm going to knock on wood, they haven't fought us about, they understand that not yet. And I've told them, you'll get it. You know, they have a desktop that they use twice a week, but no interactive, portable gaming, nothing like that. And they've been, but we had to replace the behavior. We had to expose them to music, to sports, to reading. You can't just have a kid sit in the room. You know, you've got to engage the child somehow. Yeah. There's no pause.
I've had
gamers tell me that there's no pause button on the game. You got to get to the next level. You can't pause it. If you Google World of Warcraft and diapers, Google World of Warcraft and diapers, you're going to find whole chat rooms of teenagers talking about which adult diapers are the best to use because they can't, they won't go to the bathroom for 2 or 3 days while they're playing or they're doing a raid. They won't take a 5-minute bathroom break. That's how compulsive it is. As Jeff Foxworthy would say, you might have a problem if you're not going to the bathroom, if you're going in adult diapers and you're 17. Yeah. As a carrot, you said?
It's very effective for getting him to do a lot of things for quite some time as well. But is there something about wiring of that brain where you're giving them, I mean, you obviously wouldn't do that with an alcoholic. You would never say, you know, this is really good for 3 hours, you can go to the bar. You know, so like how is the brain wiring, if you are limiting and regulating it, but is even giving it out of the word a bad way of
yeah, it's not ideal because you're still creating a value system where the game is still that you're valuing the game. The game is the reward, and so what you wind up having is like any kind of reward, kids will or adults will blow through. I'll get through that to get to that, and so in that 2020 show that I'm involved in with the triplets, they were working with a guy that was doing that. And it's problematic because, so the kid was going to day camp for 6 or 7 hours and kind of, and then racing home to the game. So that's, in education, we call that an extrinsic reward versus an intrinsic reward. So you want the real life experience to be its own reward. And that's the Holy Grail. Now, I'm not saying that's easy, but you want, you know, you want baseball to be more appealing than Minecraft. You want reading to be more appealing than Call of Duty or texting or social media. That's the challenge, and it's an uphill battle. I know it's not easy, but if you keep having the inducement be the gaming, it's going to keep magnifying over time, and because that's the value. You're creating a value system where that's king. And so if you could shift it and could begin to sort of make the values of the alternative activities be as powerful or as rewarding, that would be the ideal. Yes.
I was in an event in my local high school yesterday, and they talked about social media and how addictive that can be. And I was wondering if, since social media was invented, and if doing social media could be more addictive or as addictive as video games.
Yeah, they're also dopamine. Texting can be also, by the way. Every time you get a text, there's a concept called neophilia, which means that we crave the new. We're evolutionarily hardwired to seek new experiences. That kept us alive during the prehistoric ages. We created fire, we figured out how to forage. So we're hardwired for novelty. And so every text is a novel experience, every social media, every like, every... So there's this intersection of they're dopamine activating and they're novel. And so it's a kind of a double whammy of yes, more. So social media, texting, and they've done actually Case Western Reserve in Ohio. All roads are leading back to Ohio. They did social media. So they were called hyper-networkers and hyper-texters. A hyper-networker was somebody who was on social media more than 3 hours a day, which is like nothing, right? Are you guys, I mean, 3 hours a day isn't that much to be on social media. And hyper-texters were texting more than 120 times a day. So hyper-networkers and hyper-texters, they correlated to all sorts of bad things. Worse outcomes in school, more multiple sex partners, higher rates of drug abuse, behavioral issues. So it seemed like the more you were on social media, the more you were texting, the more you had some bad behavioral things that went with it.
Much of them have ADHD. Now, they've had ADHD since they were 4 or 5 years old.
When did they get the screens?
Before the screens? Before they got on the screen.
Okay.
So, how does that... My son wants to know how that works.
Kids that have ADHD, it's a little bit of chicken or the egg, because you know ADHD rates have gone up 50% over the last 10 years. And it correlates to when screens have also gone up in time. So some people think, I do think that screens can cause this ADHD. But if your child has pre-existing ADHD, we know that ADHD is responsive to stimulant medication. That's why Ritalin works for ADHD. Well, the screen is a stimulant. So kids who have ADHD seem like they get calmed down by screens, but then they get dependent on it. And so when the screen gets taken away, they get even more restless. And so it's like being dependent on an anti-anxiety medication like Xanax or Klonopin. It works, but then you get dependent on it. And so that becomes the slippery slope.
But I'm sorry, I'm not apologizing. But go ahead.
Yeah.
I've never been in any studies where decimal screens are causing actual vision problems, like snow or whatever it is.
Yeah, and the screen affects community. Like, so I'm the addiction guy, but there's a whole subset of screen activists that look at the radiation effects, the EMF, electromagnetic effects. And then there's a whole subset of people who are looking at the visual effects. Now, the only state, and she's a friend of mine, Cindy Eckhart in Maryland, has been, she's gotten two state legislators. Do you know Cindy Eckhart?
Not Ohio.
She got two state legislators to sponsor a bill to limit screen time in schools. And that's actually winding its way through the state legislature in Maryland this month. And she used ocular effects. And she used OSHA. OSHA is you know, the office safety workplace standards. OSHA has had protocols for office workers and screen time going back to the 1990s. So Cindy and her legislator friend said, we've been protecting office workers' eyes from screens since the 1990s. What about our kids? So she was pretty sharp. She used that as the most concrete, tangible thing to get these legislators to sponsor the bill and use the kids' vision as the issue, because that has been documented. Yeah.
Another 10% of our population is
you sprinkle out PTSD.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm also accessing. There have been times when I've escaped in that world, and I'm like, okay, this is effective. But the more I saw and presented it, I'm like, well, really what it's doing is it's hijacking me from my experience. Because it's essentially just lifting me out of my experience, putting me to a place that nothing is like, there's no way for me to grow in anything. I'm actually becoming attached, as opposed to being attached in any way. And my real question is, 10% is hardwired to become addicted to these things, which I'm an alcoholic, so I understand recovery. I've been in it for 8 years, so I understand that when I have an allergic reaction to alcohol, that I actually acted nuts. But at the same time, I've supplanted that with game modes. I didn't really play video games before, quit drinking, so there's a correlation for me as well. I understand, like, I'm on more news outlets because they're addicted to porn. I have, like, five now. Because they're just another way for me to get that same response. I completely understand. Like, I get a little dopamine shot, but sometimes I'll hit the screen early in the morning and I'm really tired because it'll pop me up. And that's just me being honest. But the thing that I'm actually concerned about is that, okay, all these things are out there and I'm affected by them, but are these studies also saying that it seems to suggest that these studies are saying that almost normal people that are wired properly, like, I'm an addicted person, I'm not wired the same way as those, that they may be also affected by this in such a way that neurologically they're actually transforming the way their brains are functioning through the mylar and other things, so that would suggest to me that this is actually not just like an innocuous problem, but actually something that's along the lines of becoming like a toxic level of things that we actually have to warn them. And if that's the case, then it's much more about this isn't just a problem for 10%, this is a problem literally for all of us.
That's what Victoria Lumpy said, that this affects even moderate level normal kids because everyone's going to get an intentional impact, no matter. So you're right, the 10% who are vulnerable to addiction, okay, let's put that subset over there, but everyone who's exposed to hyper-arousing screens is going to have an intentional impact. So if you're a better student or whatever your situation is, that may not show itself as obviously, but it's compromising your attention. So if your attentional abilities were X, now they're X minus Y. And so those effects are more subtle, but they're there. So everyone's getting impacted. It's like the fetal alcohol syndrome. No amount of alcohol for the fetus is good, but what's the tipping point to FAS? And what's you know, so there's impacts that everyone's getting. Well, you mentioned before about alcohol and addiction. We know there's the syndrome model of addiction that looks at, it's kind of like whack-a-mole, right? You play the game whack-a-mole, you hit one mold, another one pops up. Addictions tend to manifest, express themselves in a variety of ways, and people who compartmentalize their addictive behavior into substance A and demonize that, it tends to morph into another expression. And so typically, I've run rehabs, somebody stops drinking, they become, they start taking pills or sex addicts or workaholics or exercise too much or another compulsive behavior takes its place, typically. Unless the person does the interior work where then they understand their compulsive nature and then they're really much more grounded and less vulnerable to some of those addictive substitutions. Yeah.
The problem that we're having in our house these days, we have three children between grades 9, 6, and 4, and every year each of them seems to have more homework assigned that's computerized, particularly our high schooler now. And it's very hard to ascertain how much of the time it needs spent on work and how much of the time it needs on distraction, whatever you get your kids. I think the main concern I have is just about the phenomenon of less assigned to work on the computer. And I just wondered, what thoughts you have, what recommendations you have here about what to do at home, what to do in connection with schools.
Yeah, there's been a lot of grassroots parent movements throughout the country. I'm in touch with a few in Marin County and San Francisco and different parts of the country that are pushing back against their schools and are demanding that the content be presented in non-digital form as well. And the parents, let's face it, you're the taxpayers. You're the superintendent's boss. And if enough parents activate, and that's what I've seen, parents who can get together as a unified voice and say, look, we're not saying no technology,
certainly in the high school level, but elementary and middle school, we got it, because what's been happening is it's been creeping down to the kindergarten. And like you said, I mean, how many of you share the problem that this gentleman mentioned, that the schools are now forcing your kids, and it's this false narrative to make the kids digitally savvy.
Right.
And the one New York Times article, the one Google engineer who had his kids at the Waldorf School, who designs software, said, we make this stuff idiot-proof. You don't have to learn it. You know, you don't have to be digitally savvy when you're five. I was telling them before, there was a woman on Long Island who's a kindergartner. Their schools were giving tablets, iPads to kindergartners, and she demanded, I don't want my five-year-old to have a tablet. And if you give it to them, I'm going to pull them out of school. They threatened to call Child Protective Services on her. And then she got me involved, and I had to call the superintendent and you know, really threaten, you know, media and some other things. Really? You're going to force this woman's five-year-old to have a tablet when she's the parent doesn't want it? And they backed off, but it was this idea that we're just keeping up with the neighboring districts. We're doing because it's because the parents want it. It's the shiny new bauble, and it's so if enough parents who are educated and aware and present the research, and on my website, by the way, I have all the I have a whole list of the research. If you go to drcardaris.com, I have clinical screen effects, and it's all the peer-reviewed research. And I have a parent opt-out letter in my book. And parents have used that effectively to say, I want my child taught in the traditional manner up until age 10 or 12 or whatever the age that you want. And I found usually if the parent presents that and advocates for them, usually the schools will cooperate. Rarely do you get really schools that will force that on you. And especially if you threaten to pull your child out of school, I mean, that's a pretty good threat too, because schools get, if it's a public school, they get paid, you know, based on census, and so they don't want kids being pulled out either. So, but it's a problem. It's you're right. It's a significant problem.
Can I just chime in on that? I'm just going to put it out there. If anybody wants to reach me, let me have, I'm Dan Armstrong, and I'm a 12-child middle school right now in Lomarion School District. And you can look me up in the directory, because it will take parents coming together to change narratives, because as well-meaning as school board members are, they may have kids, you know, our schools or not. And if we don't come together and get a new balance, it won't happen, because it's an echo chamber in education right now. And so I'm not blaming anyone, but I think that's the best advice. And so come together as a group and neighbors and connect with teachers who are like-minded, and maybe you can do some good work.
Be that angry mob. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Wait, if your kids come to the house having a face, is it better to have a face-to-face connection? Is that what you're... You know, because again, the digital is still king at that point. You know, that's the other. The one, there's a guy, Cam Adair, who's a recovering video game addict, who's formed a website called Game Quitters, and he's helping people get off of games. And video games do something that other substances don't do. It creates a sense of achievement, and it creates an achievement loop. And so you get reinforced, and you feel good about yourself, because when you get to the next level, where other substances, you know, you don't tend to feel good about being a cocaine addict. Or, oh, I got to the next level of my cocaine use. But the idea was there was also the social connection, that gamers do feel a sense like, well, I'm socializing, because if I'm playing a multiple player game or if I'm playing face-to-face, I'm socializing. But it's not the ideal. If there was a way you could socialize without the game, it's better.
Is that better than playing by yourself?
Well, it's better than playing by yourself on screen. But it would be better to play with the other kid, not on screen.
Right.
But it goes back to the eye contact thing as well. Yes? Just fight it out. You're so polite. When did you go?
A lot of Google Drive,
Yeah, and what you're talking about, I have a whole chapter in my book about how, you know, technology takes one step forward and humanity takes two steps back. Even back to the days of the calculator in my generation, you know, we've stopped learning how to do longhand math when you got a calculator. And now you got a computer and you stop learning how to look something up because now you have Google. So those abilities, they atrophy if you don't use them. I'll ask you guys this question, because I asked this in the book. How many of you can tell me that your 10 closest friends' phone numbers without looking at your smartphones? We have one savant. We have one. But 10 years ago, most people remembered about 10 phone numbers. You got, you know, your parents, your cousins, your friends. Most people remember their 10 go-to numbers. Today, that number is less than 3 usually. You've got to, what's that person's number? Because, and so memory is a muscle that gets developed as well. And our smartphones, you know, there's an old saying, our smartphones make us dumb because they do everything for us. They autocorrect, they search, they remember things for us. So rely less on them. So if we rely less on them and we do things the old-fashioned way, we don't need the crutch as much because the crutch makes us weak. And so to force ourselves to do things the old-fashioned way is really best for the brain. And with, in terms of healthy activities, what do you love to do? If you love music, engage in music. If you love to run. What do you love? What do you love?
Softball.
Well, some play softball. Not virtual softball, right? What about, do you like to write? Do you like to, without the autocorrect, do you like to write with me? Okay. Well, you know, sometimes some kids are more, you know, more into writing or drawing or, but do, live. You know, that's the key, because the more you recede back into that digital escape, the more we atrophy, you know? And as you get older, it becomes harder to do those things. Yes? Substance or addictive behavior. So I didn't say you touch an iPad, you turn into, you know, a monster. But what role do the parents play? It's a good one, because one of the addiction ideological theories is social learning theory. So if you're the child of an addict, you're 7 times more likely to have an addiction problem. The big debate in the psychological community is whether that's genetics or what's called social learning theory. Social learning theory is basically monkey see, monkey do. Do I become an addict because my parents are an addict, because I modeled their behavior, or because my DNA is addicted? So going back to monkey see, monkey do, it's called distracted parent syndrome. So if I'm on my device all the time, not only am I modeling addictive behavior, like I'm on my phone while my... How many of you have gone to the airport and you see kids pulling at their parents' pants and the parents are, get away from me, kid, you bother me, you know, and they're on their device. So not only are they modeling that, but the other damaging part is they're not nurturing that child in the way that's most impactful developmentally. Children need eye-to-eye nurturing. And so not only am I, so I'm effectively neglecting my child emotionally. I'm in the same room. When I did that intervention in Ohio, beautiful Columbus, last week, we had 4 children. I sat with the 10-year-old. Sweetest kid you could ever meet. Really polite, respectful little 10-year-old. Hi, how are you, sir? And he sat down. We did this, and then we were talking. He liked playing baseball. He liked playing third base. And then eventually we got around to asking him, tell me about your dad. How does it, you know, does your dad play baseball with you? I never saw, started hyperventilating, sobbing. And when he was finally able to compose him, I'm sorry, we had to call 911. He was so shaken up. He was so upset. He said, my dad chooses the games over me He loves them more than me. And so he's not getting the nurturing that he needs from his father. Like any addicted parent, look, if a parent's addicted, they're not nurturing their children in the way that those kids need to be nurtured. We know that. So, you know, there's a whole host of issues of what the parent's role is in this. But if you have your own screen issues and you're raising young children, you do have to look at your own modeling behavior as well, is my bottom line with that. Yes?
How do you know when your child needs help or when your child is just managing, or what kind of help do you get from them? Do you treatment? What do you do? How do you know?
Right. So, I mean, it depends how severe the problem is, but usually if you're seeing it's a creeping problem, you know, a digital detox is not a bad idea where you... Before we talked about the HPA, the adrenal thermostat getting raised too high, it takes about 4 to 6 weeks for the adrenal thermostat to go back down to baseline. So if you take away the electronics for a month, not punitively, but just to recalibrate your child's adrenal system, the first 48 hours they're going to be agitated, but then they'll calm down and keep them busy with something else. So sometimes you need to do what we call a tech fast or a digital detox to get your child back to baseline. And that you can do it at home. Victoria Dunkley wrote a great book, Reset Your Child's Brain. And she walks you through how to do a digital detox. If it gets severe, then you need treatment. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of therapists versed in this either. This is a problem that's new to a lot of therapists as well. Yeah.
So thank you very much for your talk. The problem I'm saying is we are very self-selective with what we look at. And the question I've heard before, you know, with all respect, is that these cases are fantastic because they're really dramatic, but they're important that the streamer is good. What I see is it's not only 10%, it's much higher than that. It's at different levels. And what we really probably need to describe is that people get affected in much more subtle ways every day. And people, a great example, the problem is to have people, you know, they don't have this group of, you know, in the community. But the problem is, we get these faces, you know, sometimes, man, 5 out of 10 are like, you're an ally, you're an artist. We're both physicians, and actually, addiction as well in my past. And the problem is, there's all the different, you know, we have to make it like this. If we can find a way to also say, these are the dramatic examples that are extreme, there are other ways that they are really going to affect the kids. We can get it out of there without being an artist, that would be fantastic.
Well, I think to some degree, you're right. And that's, you know, I had that discussion with my publisher sometimes, you know, because when you show the extreme cases, it's easy to say, well, those are the extreme cases, those must have had some other issues. But it's also a wake-up call to say, if they can do this effect, but I do try to say, kind of what you had said, the 10% is the addictive piece, but all kids are getting impacted, too, varying and more subtle or more profound. Look, society has gotten impacted. We've been impacted, the adults. So this has been a global seismic shift in 10 to 12, 13 years. We have changed as a species in the blink of an eye. And evolutionarily, it takes 50 generations for our DNA to change. So we're still in hunter-gatherer bodies, but now we've got this information overload that's happening. And what is that doing to us as a species? What is that going to look like 50 years from now? And so all I'm suggesting is caution and to try to really slow this down a little bit, because at this rate, 50 years from now, we won't even be able to recognize ourselves. I was talking about the gentleman who invented the HoloLens, Alex Kripman, you know, virtual reality, the headsets, the HoloLens. Google the TED Talk by Alex Kripman and tell me you're not going to hide under your bed for 10 minutes. He looks like a mad scientist. He sounds like a mad scientist. I have invented the HoloLens, and this would be the future of the world. I'm sorry for the nefarious bad German accent, but he sounds crazy. And he wants all of us to walk around in a virtual headset, and he says, and this will connect us as human beings,
through technology, we will all be connected to our own. And then he's on this TED Talk, and he waves his hand, and purple mushrooms rise up, these augmented realities, and then he holographically beams his partner from across the street onto the stage. And it's insane, and it's scary, and it's frightening, and he's over at Microsoft working hard. So the future can be, you know, unless we say stop, let's slow this stuff down a little bit, you know, we won't be able to recognize ourselves as a species in two generations.
I'll go there. This will have to be our last question. I'm sorry. You've been so generous with your time, but this will have to be our last question.
Okay.
Well, in England, there's
make it a good one.
Mission on children, I think as of January, they're recommending like a digital bar and mandatory education in the classroom.
Oh, in England. Oh, I'm sorry. So digital czar is like a good thing, like not giving out the digital device.
To help kind of rein in and, and create mandatory programs within in the classroom. Do you know of any efforts to do anything? I do know there was social media day or
just unplug day.
Every night. Yeah. Something downtown in Philadelphia for it. Here. But the high school's done unplug days.
Under effort and the marketing of the ed. When you can bring that up like this, the ed tech device in the marketing is, you know, overpowering.
In South Korea, every student, teacher, therapist, and parent gets a little technology manual with a little bit of a primer and the warnings, and because they're very sensitized to it. In South Korea, they have 400 tech rehabs. In China, they have internet addiction disorder as their number one health crisis, with over 20 million Chinese teenagers diagnosed with IAD, internet addiction disorder. Now, they treat them kind of barbarically. They don't have, I don't prescribe to their treatment protocols, but they're ahead of us in terms of identifying the problem and raising awareness to it. And you're right, digital czar sounds like a great idea. Let's put that into situation. But thank you all for